satellite imagery coming through.
We have before us the opportunity to forge a new world order.
This bill will require the storage of personal, private information.
We know that these are testing times for everyone here and for everyone sworn to protect democratic freedoms.
This is the Something to Hide podcast from the Sadly Lacking Network. I'm your host, Sean, and this is Season 2, Episode 1, Physical Security. If you're just tuning in, this is a show looking at the personal privacy of individuals living in Australia, as well as information about personal PC security. As I mentioned, this is Episode 1 of the second season. So if this is the first time you've tuned in, make sure you go back and check out all of the episodes from Season 1. There was a lot of good information in Season 1, and we touched on everything from the National Security Legislation Amendment Bill to the Piracy Bill to search engines, PGP, IDM, mobile phone security, and more. In this show, I also try and play some of the latest music I've discovered, Australian-based or otherwise. I do try and keep the music focused to Australia, but sometimes I find something out there that just needs to be played, and I play it, regardless of where it's come from. So you can look forward to a lot of good music coming out in Season 2 as well this year. Look, a lot has happened since last season, and I thought that the best way to catch up was to start out the show by reevaluating the current political climate in Australia and any changes in legislation that have happened since. I guess the biggest change has been the Prime Minister. The PM in Australia is basically, quote-unquote, the person in charge, and that used to be Tony Abbott. Now, Tony was not a very popular man, and under his regime, a lot of things came into place that are a direct threat to your personal privacy. Not only did he put in some very dodgy immigration laws, but more than anything else, he was responsible for actively trying to dismantle the Freedom of Information Act. This is essential in an open and democratic society, and yet Tony wanted to abolish the guy in charge of the Freedom of Information Act, and also he wanted to start charging people $800 a pop to find out information that is literally deemed free in the title. At the same time, while under Tony's leadership, the government introduced the Telecommunications Interception and Access Bill. This is the bill that essentially says all of your metadata must be collected and retained for up to 2 years. That is now law, and active data collection and retention is happening. At the time this bill was introduced, Malcolm Turnbull was the Minister for Communications. Well, now Turnbull is the guy in charge. Yes, the man responsible for introducing national surveillance legislation has led a political coup against Mr. Abbott and is now the Prime Minister. A lot's been said about Mr. Turnbull and his supposed ability to lead the country, whether it be for better or for worse. To be honest, my concerns about Australian privacy have not changed. In fact, I'd say that they're probably going to grow. At the time of this show, Turnbull hasn't done too much to change the direction of the country other than put himself in charge and declare that he wants to make Australia a Silicon Valley, a second Silicon Valley. So we'll have to wait and see if anything actually changes. So what have we got? Well, there's now a bill that allows the Australian government to revoke citizenship of dual nationals. Basically, the bill is intended for citizens that engage in, quote-unquote, terrorism-related conduct. So if the Australian government decides your actions are, in fact, terrorism, and you're a dual national, see you later. Not only are you most likely jailed, but you aren't allowed the same rights as other Australian citizens. And look, I understand this legislation in theory, but again, in practice, it sounds a bit dodgy to me. Previously, a citizen had to be convicted of a specific offense before their citizenship could be revoked, which is completely understandable. I get that. If you did something horrible and you were convicted of a crime under Australian criminal court, fine, you lose. Your citizenship can be revoked, and it would have been revoked. After all, dual citizenship is not an equal right. You know, it is not the same thing as, say, someone who's born in that country. And you may disagree with me on that, but I don't think it's entirely unreasonable. There's a difference between a naturalized citizen and, I guess, someone who's born there. Completely in the sense that, you know, 9 times out of 10, they still have both of their citizenships. They don't lose that by coming to Australia. Some countries, of course, are different. China would be a good one. They make you choose. But look, if you're going to go through that process of becoming a terrorist, whatever, you're risking a lot. However, under this new bill, now you only have to, quote-unquote, engage in conduct that is deemed to be terrorism. Now, that seems a bit of a wide-sweeping category, don't you think? You don't even have to be convicted of a crime to lose your citizenship. You lose your rights before you're found guilty of a crime. That's hardly a democratic process. Otherwise, at the moment, it seems that the government's kind of focused on themselves. That is, they're focused on the reshuffle of seats in the cabinet, of minister appointments, and of who's backstabbing whom, rather than focusing on, you know, governing. It's a strange thing to me that the party can decide to just sack the guy in charge, you know, get rid of the prime minister, but that's the way it works in Australia, so we'll wait and see what happens. In other news, the UN has appointed a special rapporteur on the right to privacy, Joseph Canetacci. So this is a new position at the UN, and it is probably worth explaining what a special rapporteur is. Essentially, this is an individual who specializes in a particular subject, in this case privacy, and reports back on the issues to the Human Rights Council at the UN. So this new position has been created as the UN has recognized the rights to privacy in the digital age, which is something that I mentioned last season. So, Joseph Canetacci started off his appointment with a bit of press that drew some attention around the world to his position on the existing surveillance state worldwide. He essentially said that the surveillance oversight mechanisms in the UK were a joke, and that it was worse than what George Orwell could have ever imagined. His stance seems rather strong on privacy, and he has decades of experience in digital policy and telecommunications law. And it's really good news to see that the UN has created this position. It essentially means that online privacy has been raised to the status of a human rights level issue. As I mentioned before, I'll keep an eye on any further developments at the UN around privacy, and he is tasked with a very large job. Essentially reviewing all government policies and laws on the interception and collection of personal data. And then he's got to provide guidance on how to revise those laws to basically the world. So, yeah, no small task, Joseph. Good luck. Additionally, as part of his mandate, he wants to review the business model of large corporations like Facebook and Twitter, which have based their business on the collection of personal information and then selling that as currency. So we'll have to wait and see what comes from Mr. Canetacci, but very interesting. In other privacy news, in Australia, it was recently revealed that Vodafone, the very large telecommunications company, unlawfully accessed a journalist's phone records after she broke a story about a very large data breach at that company. Here's the ABC with a summary of the story.
Not for the first time, Malcolm Turnbull has proved such a big story that others have been diminished in his presence, which means there are some stories around this week that haven't got the traction they deserve. One of them has a real relevance to journalists, as Paul Farrell from Guardian Australia explains.
So in 2011, Fairfax journalist Natalie O'Brien broke quite a major story about a very serious data breach at Vodafone. But what she wasn't aware of at the time was that at some point after she broke that story, a Vodafone employee accessed her phone and call records.
How serious a data breach? What are we talking about? What sort of information was available and who was getting hold of it?
It was an incredibly serious data breach because it was essentially details relating to customers' personal information that was made very easily accessible to quite a broad number of Vodafone employees.
So addresses, driver's license, credit card numbers, that sort of thing.
That sort of thing, potentially, exactly, yes. And, of course, Natalie did a fantastic story on that at the time. But at some point after that, her phone records were accessed by an employee within Vodafone.
And what was the rationale, or what do we believe the rationale? Were they trying to find what her source is?
So according to emails that The Australian has obtained and published, there is a very strong case to be made that the accessing of Natalie's phone records were to determine who her sources were. Now, Vodafone denies that and says that that was not the case and that these employees were not instructed to do that. And they say they undertook a review that found that no one in Vodafone management instructed these employees to take that action.
Is it illegal for a telecoms company to access its own customers' personal phone records in this way?
We'll have to certainly wait and to see what the Australian Federal Police determine in the course of their inquiries into this for this particular incident. But it certainly is an offence under the Telecommunications Act for a telecommunications provider to access information in that sort of way, yes.
But when did we learn of this?
What's quite extraordinary about this is that we've only just learned about this over the weekend since the report in The Australian. That's obviously extremely concerning because what is indisputable and what Vodafone do not deny is that their management was aware of this in 2012. They knew that their employee had accessed this journalist's phone records, but they chose not to notify her and they chose not to notify any external agency about it.
So why has it taken so long?
A reasonable inference that could be drawn is that the company did not want this information out there because it knew it would be extremely damaging. It had just suffered a major data breach that they'd been publicly exposed for by, in fact, the very journalist whose phone records they then subsequently accessed. It's certainly reasonable to draw the conclusion that perhaps they didn't want this to come out in public, so they decided not to publicise it at the time.
Natalie O'Brien, who this is all about, she's written about this, hasn't she?
She has written about it, and she's really captured, I think, just how devastating and creepy this is. She wrote a really excellent piece over the weekend in the Sydney Morning Herald about how she felt as though her privacy had been completely and utterly invaded. And I think for all journalists, that's something we can really understand. I mean, confidence is essentially our most important touchstone. We have to have confidence, and we have to keep our sources confidential in order to do our jobs.
Paul, I've spoken to you before about, I suppose, having the best possible practice when it comes to trying to keep sources secure. What does this tell us about how secure we can be?
Well, I think this really highlights again just how general mobile communications, that's, you know, text messages and calls, are so vulnerable in so many different ways. Of course, you've got the issues surrounding law enforcement access to that kind of information. But then, you know, just one step closer, what this case really illustrates is what happens when telecommunications companies and people within them choose to misuse that personal data. So I think it really shows that mobile communications, you know, when you're talking about text messages, are extremely vulnerable and that journalists should be very careful about how they use those kind of messages. And certainly, if they are using mobile devices, I think there's at least a level more security to use mobile applications such as Signal or Threema or Wickr instead.
And of course, we don't know whether any other mobile phone company has done this at all.
I mean, this is the extraordinary thing. I mean, this is one case that has appeared, you know, in a very strange and unusual way through these leaked emails in The Australian. But we really have no idea whether or not this could have occurred before. And what I can tell you is, because I'm working on a story about this at the moment, is that there are so many other companies that have been involved in catastrophic data breaches and they don't disclose them. Companies in these sort of positions don't disclose when serious things happen because they're worried about it. They're worried about the implications from their business. But sometimes if they do that, they end up making things far, far worse for themselves.
Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks very much.
Paul Farrell from Guardian Australia. This is The Media Report with me, Richard Adey.
What they don't mention in that story, and what is truly worrisome to me, is that the chief executive of Vodafone at the time, Bill Morrow, is now the chief executive of the Australian National Broadband Network. Yep, he's the guy in charge of replacing the existing telecommunications infrastructure in Australia with technology overseen by the government, which is being sold off to private companies. Great. Look, I think it's time for a break. Let's let all that sink in, and we'll come back and talk about physical security. That was The Dirty Three with The Restless Waves. The Dirty Three is an instrumental rock band from Melbourne, Australia. They formed in 1992, so they've been around for quite some time. They are apparently best heard live, and I really get that vibe from their music. Luckily, they're playing an upcoming festival here in Sydney, so I'm going to get to see them perform live soon. But good band, check out more of their music, available on iTunes. So, physical security is something that's particularly important, but is often overlooked or not mentioned when talking about keeping your information safe. So it's really long overdue that we talk about it, and you can't forget the importance of physical security. After all, it's the bottom layer. Truth be told, I'm in that group of people that don't do much on the side of physical security, so this is a bit of an exercise for me as well. I mean, yes, we live in an apartment building several stories up, and yes, we keep our doors locked, but really, you know, we're not doing too much other than that. And there is something that as a family we don't do, but should, in securing the perimeter of our house that is very, very easy. It's a very easy way to get in if someone really wanted to. Now, for obvious reasons, I'm not going to mention what that is here, but my point is that even a guy who makes a podcast about security can get a bit lazy about physical security. I mentioned the word perimeter. Now, that's really important when it comes to physical security, especially of your home, because that's how people get in, and that's what you don't want them to do. So the perimeter of your house or your apartment, your whatever, is a good place to start for physical security. It should go without saying that you need locks on your doors and your windows, and you should keep your perimeter secure, but good place to start. I would also suggest not leaving your computer out in the open. If someone is going to break in and steal your computer, it makes it a lot easier for them if they can see it, you know, as soon as they get in the house. So it's definitely a good idea to put something away if you're not going to use it. I fully admit, though, that I do not follow this rule myself. My laptop sits near the couch, which is where I usually do my computing. It's very easy to get to. But I highly recommend you do it. Do you have your laptop password protected? Because that's a very easy way for your PC to stay just that little bit safer if someone does manage to get physical access to it. It only takes an extra 10 seconds to type in your password, but depending on the sophistication of the criminal or the person trying to break into your machine, it could be enough to deter them from, you know, even attempting it. So I recommend putting in a password on your laptop or your desktop. Do not forget about backups. Backups are important. And make sure you do it often, and make sure that you do it regularly. Drives fail, liquids spill, fires burn. I would suggest backing things up double, both in an online solution like Carbonite, as well as using a physical medium like an external hard drive or CDs, DVDs, that kind of thing. And those backups, make sure that both your primary drive on your machine as well as your backup drives are all encrypted. Make sure that those things are encrypted. That way, even if your machine manages to get stolen, anybody trying to access your data will have a really difficult time. If you want to take things to the next level in physical security, you can get a cable lock for your computer. And a lot of companies do this. Kensington locks are a popular brand and fairly straightforward to attach to a laptop or a PC. Most modern machines will have a slot or a loop somewhere to attach one of these cable locks. You can also install surveillance cameras in your home, if you're into that. But I should warn you, a lot of online surveillance camera software is extremely unsecure. And companies that are supposedly professionals will come in and install the cameras and the software, but then do nothing to protect that software from any sort of intrusion itself. In other words, if you're not sure what you're doing, you could possibly end up broadcasting videos of your home out to the world without knowing it. Trust me, I have seen this firsthand. It can happen. So if you decide to go down the route of installing surveillance cameras that you can access online, make sure you understand enough about securing your perimeter of your own home network to make sure that no one else can access that information easily. Also, physical security. Don't forget about your trash, your actual garbage. There is a lot of valuable information thrown away every single day. And chances are that I could find your name, your address, your birth date, your car rego, your credit card, bank account number, bank account details, and probably more, all from your trash. So keep this in mind when you're throwing things away or recycling them. I always rip or shred things that have any personal information on them before chucking them out. It's a good practice to get into, and it's not hard. You can even invest in a cheap paper shredder if you're keen. Also, make sure to turn the oven off before you leave the house. Look, I'm not going to go into this in too much detail, but those are just a few tips that I wanted to share to keep your information a bit safer around the house. And you can really go deep with physical security and surveillance of your own home if you want, but use the internet. That's how you got this podcast, after all. The internet is your best resource for information on this stuff, and there is a lot of information out there. You know, a lot of physical security doesn't require technical skills or technical knowledge the way that you would have some advanced, security techniques for information on your computer or information on your mobile phone. Physical security has been around for a very long time. So there's a lot of proven techniques, a lot of things you can do, regardless of whether you're protecting a computer or protecting the crown jewels, the same concepts would apply. Use the internet, get some more information if you want it out there. I'm looking forward to getting into some cool stuff in season two of the show. We've got a lot of things to cover, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Now, today's show took information from ABC Radio, the Sydney Morning Herald, Wikipedia, The Guardian, and countless online Stay Safe articles about information security and home protection. Next time on Something to Hide, malware detection and a look at the history of privacy invasion. Stay tuned. And as always, thanks for listening.
Just don't beat the